From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com.
We are broadcasting live from Baltimore. We are at the National Postal Forum, which is a partner of the United States Postal Service. And I was looking and doing some research about the United States Postal Service. And I was surprised to find that if this were a private company, last year it would have been the 39th biggest company in the 2016 Fortune 500 corporations, which is impressive. And with us to give us a little bit of more perspective on both the company and the broader market for shipping and frankly, making mail relevant in an era where people are hooked to their phones, is Kristen Seaver, Chief Information Officer and Executive Vice President of the United States Postal Service. She joins us here now. So, you know, Kristen, one thing that we've been hearing a lot about is the importance to sort of transform the way people think about mail, the way that they track it, the way that they observe it and experience it. What do you think is going to be the biggest challenge in the year ahead as you sort of look out, try to make it modern, but also cater to nostalgia and, you know, also the Amazonification of our world?
Absolutely. Well, you know, I think one of our greatest challenges is going to be to keep pace. We've done a lot of work, as you'll see at the National Postal Forum, in building technologies and platforms to track mail, to provide value to mail. But our challenge is to keep that mail relevant, to work with our customers, to help them grow their businesses, and to work, as every industry has to do right now, at an incredible pace to keep up and leverage these technologies to the best extent.
How difficult is it? I was just looking at the U.S. Postal Service's recent income statement, and there was a $474 million year-over-year decline in the second quarter, and it was in large part due to having to pre-fund 75 years of retiree health benefits. And how much of that is a pressure on being able to adapt to the changing environment?
Yeah, the Postal Service faces significant pressure when it comes to our finances and how we're run. And we really have three things that we're trying to focus on. The first is for the Postal Service to adapt quickly and to manage its operation to react to declining volumes, but also to compete where volumes are increasing.
Right.
So that's quite a challenge. Our other two challenges are legislative and regulatory, and we have a positive bill that came out of committee for postal reform that's really important to us.
What's the substance of it?
The substance of the postal reform bill is basically allows us to address our retiree health benefit issue with integrating Medicare, allows us to use Postal Service demographics instead of federal government demographics. If you think about the Postal Service, we have workers all over the United States in varying income levels. It allows us to take back some of the exigent price increase, and it also gives us a little bit of flexibility for some new products and services that we're excited about.
Well, so since we all talk about Amazon so much, and Amazon is just decimating the entire retail sector, as a lot of people have been saying, do you find that the U.S. Postal Service is able to keep up from a technological point of view in being able to deliver all of the boxes? And can you give us a sense of how much the just sheer volume of packages has increased over the past few years?
Yeah, we've had double-digit increase in package volume year over year for the last 3 years. But the thing that's been great about the Postal Service is that we have the delivery muscle to flex it. We go to every house. We go to every business. And it's really been an opportunity for us to showcase our strength, what we've been doing for over 240 years.
But aren't there a lot more competitors? Because people are looking and saying, wow, this is the future, right? This is the reality is that you're going to be able to order something, pick something up, and then it's going to come to your home. And so there are going to be some probably shippers and delivery companies that are going to try to compete.
So absolutely. So one of the advantages we have is we've already built out our network. And we leverage that network. The other thing is, even with competition, which is fierce, but we still deliver more e-commerce packages than any other provider in the country. And we will continue to leverage our brand, our trusted presence in everybody's business and community to compete and to win for that package delivery.
We were talking earlier about drones. Are those on your radar?
They have to, as the chief information officer, absolutely, and I get that question a lot.
Okay, so how do you foresee drones playing into the United States Postal Service's business plan in the near future?
Well, I think for us what's important is we have many use cases for delivery, right? We deliver in urban areas, we deliver in rural areas, we deliver in the Grand Canyon. So maybe there's
you do?
A...
There, do you maybe do drop down packages into the Colorado River?
We go down and we've had delivery on burrows into the Grand Canyon.
No.
So that might be a possible use case of drone delivery for the Postal Service. Right? There are some places that are hard to get to. And we definitely foresee uses like that, but we can also use it to survey our own infrastructure. There's many different use cases. So what we're doing is staying in touch with the technology, staying in touch with the regulations, and really scrubbing our use cases to see where our best fit's going to be.
You know, we've talked about how the German Postal Service in particular has looked at autonomous driving vehicles to help reduce costs and increase the delivery predictability. Has that been on your radar at all?
Absolutely. We have some efforts with autonomous, working with academic institutions as far as what would be the use case, how would we use it in the Postal Service. For us, you know, one of the things is we have such a significantly large fleet. So over 270,000 vehicles, so that have to be driven and maintained throughout the country to deliver the mail every day. And now we deliver 7 days a week. So we definitely foresee that we'll have use cases for autonomous vehicles, whether it's in actual delivery or we're also a huge logistics provider. We have to get the mail from across the country.
So how much has the ratio between letters and packages changed? I imagine that once upon a time there were more letters and fewer packages, and now it has reversed, right?
It hasn't fully reversed.
It hasn't, okay.
No, letters are still the predominant product that we have, but basically as letters are declining, packages are increasing. So we haven't crossed that great divide of where total letter volume is less than packages. But, you know, the decline in letter volume is concerning, and that's why we have to compete for the package business and continue to deliver for the American public.
What's going to be the number one technological advancement in the next year for USPS?
I think the number one advancement that we'll be able to leverage is our advanced analytics platform. To continue to provide value to the mail, but also to find ways to enhance our own business and to find those opportunities that might allow us to reduce cost, might allow us to produce new products. We've put a lot of investment into that over the last 3 years, and now that's finally coming to fruition.
Kind of what we talked about before, about being able to, with Preetha Mehra, talking about how people can look and scan and see what's in their mailboxes without actually being there, and possibly even use some of the advertisement flyers.
Absolutely.
And sort
informed
of engage.
Delivery.
Yeah.
Today, this year at the National Postal Forum, we have two major platforms that we're leveraging, informed delivery and informed visibility, and they really go hand in hand. So informed delivery is exciting because every consumer has access to it and can sign up and you know, tomorrow be looking at those images of their mail.
Thank you so much for joining us, Kristen Seaver. It was really a pleasure to speak with you. Kristen Seaver is Chief Information Officer and Executive Vice President of the United States Postal Service here in Baltimore, Maryland, where we are broadcasting live from the National Postal Forum. Right now, however, I want to bring in Jonathan Nicholson, senior reporter at Bloomberg BNA, to give us some perspective on what we've gleaned so far from President Trump's hoped budget, anyway, and how likely it is that he is going to get through some of what he wants. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us. Jonathan, what have we gleaned so far about what President Trump would like to see in the budget?
Well, He goes through a lot of, one could argue, sort of fiscal gymnastics to try and sort of square the circle of doing tax reform, increasing defense, but also trying to get to something close to balance by the end of 10 years, which has been a long-term Republican budget goal for a long time. So in doing so, basically, they rely on some economic growth projections that people have some questions about, and they rely right. on some deep cuts in both non-defense discretionary and some mandatory entitlement spending programs.
So I'll just go through some of the headlines that I've been looking at, some of the information people have said that it would hit, you know, all of the welfare and sort of entitlement programs other than Medicaid, for example. It would strip away a lot more there. It would make it tougher to get some of the tax breaks for lower income individuals. It would remove money for some of the offices that have been expanded under former President Obama in favor of bolstering defense, right? I mean, is that basically the gist? I mean, what are sort of the areas that you think are going to stick and have staying power through all of the congressional negotiations that are inevitable?
Well, it's actually kind of tough to see exactly how much will stick and what specifically will stick. Congressional Republicans are actually, in many cases, being very publicly neutral and privately not very accepting of this.
Really? I'm surprised.
Well, because, you know, it's one thing to say that you want to balance the budget and so on. It's quite another when it actually comes to actually having to put the where the rubber meets the road. And so one of the things is basically we just had the House chairman of the Appropriations Committee, Mr. Frelinghuysen, put out a very neutral, neither for it nor against it kind of statement just a couple of minutes ago. Where he said, yeah, our job as appropriators is to exercise the power of the purse, which is not really that newsy because that is their job.
Right. So it's basically a non-statement. He doesn't really want to comment on it one way or another. Can we get a sense of history here with what past presidents have done when they've released their budgets or their proposed budgets? How much support do they generally get in advance from either congressmen of their same party or reach across the aisle? I mean, usually is there legwork that's done ahead of time or is this always the opening salvo?
It's certainly an opening salvo. I mean, the running joke, it's almost cliche to even joke about it now, is that no matter what the party mix is of who holds the Congress and who holds the White House, that when the president sends up a budget, someone will always say, quote, it's dead on arrival. And that is the case with this one. The interesting thing here is that this is the first year budget that has taken this long to send it up. And it still is lacking the details of the tax reform proposal that they want to get to agreement on with the House and Senate Republicans. And yet it still is this got this very the appropriators don't like the cuts to discretionary spending. The moderates don't like the cuts to some of the entitlements, some of the social net programs. So it's kind of interesting that usually if you do have a budget that has some degree of momentum to it, it usually is the president's first year budget. And in that sense, what we're seeing here today, particularly even with Trump even out of the country while this budget is being dropped, is not nearly, I think, historically what we usually see in terms of first year budget reaction.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that President Trump is out of the country, because that was my first comment, too. Why is he doing it now while he's not here to kind of do the rounds with it and give people an explanation of why he's so behind this particular plan, especially if people are coming out with pretty neutral expressions of, you know, how they assess it? Is that typical? You're kind of implying not so much. And if it's not typical, was this planned this way or did it just sort of happen this way?
Well, he was. They picked this budget release date maybe about 2 weeks ago or so. I think by then they probably already had. I would suspect at least they already had the dates locked in for the international trip that he's on now. I do not recall the last time a president was out of the country when his budget dropped, but I also haven't checked, so I wouldn't necessarily read too much into that. But you're okay. Right. Usually, it is a day when the president says, you know, here's what we stand for fiscal policy-wise. And today that burden is being basically borne by Mick Mulvaney, who is, you know, as a cabinet member, is an OMB person, but is not, you know, not the president.
So can you give me a sense, Jonathan, of what the next steps are, sort of how this will move and be potentially implemented, if at all?
There's sort of two things to watch for. Basically, the House and Senate budget committees will take this under advisement, you know, take a look at it. They will do their own budget resolutions probably in June. They have to do a budget resolution if Republicans hope to, for fiscal 18, if the Republicans hope to do tax reform with Republican-only votes as they plan. So what you look for in that is whether or not they set up some reconciliation instructions for tax reform and for some of these spending cuts that Trump is wanting. So that's one measure of how much of this will get actually potentially enacted into law. The other aspect is the appropriations processes. Will the appropriators mark to the $1.065 trillion of appropriated dollars that are set up in this budget? And that seems to be a little bit closer to being to happening. I think there's still a question of how they do the defense non-defense mix, which they probably will not do as much of a mix toward defense as Trump has proposed.
Jonathan, I'm looking at a headline on the Bloomberg. Trump's $3.6 trillion budget cuts hit his own supporters hard. In other words, the people who are going to be the worst benefited or the least benefited from his current proposal are some of the people who supported him the most. Can you explain how that is?
There's a lot of political reporting about how much of his support was in sort of hard scrabble, economically tough areas, West Virginia, Kentucky, so on. And in those areas, many of those, many, that's probably the wrong way to put it, but a certain proportion are on, say, Social Security disability, which is one of the things that is proposed to be cut on this. Another is SNAP, what used to be called food stamps. So this certainly looks at those areas, and to the extent that those are concentrated among rural supporters of Trump, it would indeed be sort of biting the hand.
I want to bring in back Jonathan Nicholson, senior reporter at Bloomberg BNA, to give us a little bit of perspective. Jonathan, what stood out to you as sort of the most important thing that Mick Mulvaney just said?
There were two things that struck me. One is he's kind of picked the 3% growth rate as his hill to die on, which I think is going to be a tough sell when he appears before the budget committees tomorrow and the day after. A lot of mainstream economists think that that's just not credible, and so that's the fact that he stuck to his guns on that seems that that's going to be an issue. The other thing was he changed his wording on Social Security to say Social Security retirement. Now, in the past couple of days and the previews and so on, they've been talking about they don't touch Social Security. But I think when they're doing disability insurance, which is part of the Social Security program and is included when you hear those dates about when Social Security goes bankrupt and so on, it's a separate trust fund that they put the old age survivors trust fund and the disability insurance trust fund together, call Social Security and say it goes bankrupt in XYZ year or so on.
Right.
I think it's interesting that he sort of walked that back to say Social Security retirement as seemingly a tacit acknowledgement of that criticism that they were trying to be evasive there.
You know, I thought it was also interesting that the way that the Trump administration is going to measure the success of programs and the compassion of programs is not how many people they serve, but by how many people get off of some of the entitlement programs. Did that stand out to you, or what does that actually mean to you?
That's a longstanding rhetorical point that a lot of anti-spending Republicans have. Basically, you can't measure the success of programs by the amount of money spent. Now, there's usually a pass for this given for defense because defense its budget has about doubled over the last 17 years or so. But now the other aspect of that is he has a point in the sense that CBO does assume that if inflation is 3%, then for a program to do the same thing next year is it needs at least a 3% increase. So in that sense, there are sort of inflation expectations ratcheted into the CBO nonpartisan baseline.
You know, I thought that it was also, you know, I want to go back to the wall comments, because people have said that there really hasn't been much money put aside to finance this program to build a wall between the United States and Mexico. People question perhaps President Trump doesn't really mean a physical wall, but something that's a little bit more of a mix between more surveillance and some physical building. But Mick Mulvaney said we are dead serious about the border wall, and this is one of his top three priorities. What does that What does that signify? And where's the money going to come from?
Well, in the budget, they do have $1.6 billion for the wall, at least to sort of get it started. I think the significance of that is that when it comes time in September, everyone here on the Hill seems resigned to the idea already that we're looking at a continuing resolution come September 30th to keep the government open. And so that will mean that, again, there will need to be Democratic support for doing so. And so that's where you set up this question whether we're going to have a shutdown showdown, whether Trump will follow through on what he said a couple of weeks ago about, you know, a good shutdown, things like that. And so in that debate, should that happen in September, as people seem to expect, this question of wall funding, which was sort of worked through and sort of elided or sort of, you know, kind of danced around in the last omnibus, if that truly is one of the top three priorities for the administration, then that could be a very big sticking point come September. That would be my, that raises a flag there, seems to me.
And just going back to what you were saying about the 3% growth rate, you flagged, and rightly so, that a lot of economists say that is not probable in the near term. You have people, including Harvard professor Larry Summers, coming out and saying that just does not seem in the cards, given the fact that you do have an aging population and just generally slower growth around the world. Do you expect there to be hearings where we have economists coming in and sort of throwing cold water on that 3% rate, or is this it? I mean, is this going to be basically you either have to accept it or you aren't even going to debate on the same playing field with respect to this budget?
I assume it'll be a little bit more of a he said, she said. I mean, I think the Republicans control, you know, the both chambers, so that they can control what hearings are called. I'm sure if Democrats control one of the chambers, they would love to have a hearing on what are realistic economic growth projections, given the aging and less productive workforce. But that doesn't mean that the Democratic senators won't bring this up during the hearings tomorrow in the House Budget Committee, or the hearing tomorrow or the hearing Thursday at the Senate Budget Committee. This has been something that people have been sort of zeroing in on for a couple of days now, in terms of possible bones of contention with this budget, and it is such a you know, there are some people, the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget bipartisan group the other week said they thought, you know, maybe you can get up to 2.1, 2.2 if you did some reform, but there'd be, I think the phrase was, quote, pretty heroic to get to 3% from the current 1.8, 1.9 long-term trend growth.
Jonathan Nicholson, thank you so much for joining us and breaking down what we've just listened to. Jonathan Nicholson is a senior reporter at Bloomberg.
We want to take a moment to let you know about something new from Bloomberg. Starting right now, you can use our iOS app or our new Google Chrome extension to scan any news story on any website, instantly revealing relevant news and market data from Bloomberg and other sources related to the companies and people you're reading about. So no matter where you're reading the news, you can bring the power of Bloomberg's news and data with you. It's pretty amazing. Download our iOS app or search for the Bloomberg extension on the Chrome store to try it out. Learn more at Bloomberg.com/lens.
Well, it is my honor to bring in Chris Hewlett, who is manager of U.S. drone-powered solutions for PricewaterhouseCoopers, which is based in Washington, D.C., also a former Navy pilot for 21 years. And he joins us now to talk about a very hot topic when it comes to all things delivery, which is drones, and the sort of dream that a lot of people have that one day we will look up in the skies and we will just see an army of drones dropping packages at our footsteps and delivering everything on demand. So, Chris, thanks so much for joining us. Cass, I'd love to get your take first. As we talk about this transition or adaptation of mail in a digital era, how much do drones really play into that at this point?
Right. Thanks, Lisa, for having me here today. And it's an interesting conversation because right now the drone addressable drone market, which we talked about by 2020, $127 billion for drone applications. And what part of that is the delivery piece? And you take a look at last mile deliveries, which a lot of people are doing experimentation with, and really it gets down to an addressable market. So what's the addressable market?
Before you go on to drone application, can you give us a sense of what that means?
Okay, so drone application. It's famously quoted. There are companies out there that state that their package deliveries, 86% of them weigh less than 5 pounds. So less than 5 pounds is easily addressable with a drone. And then there's other companies that are large retail chains that speak about the statistic that 70% of Americans alone live within 5 miles of a large retail outlet. So now you're talking about an addressable market, right? So
okay,
an application.
Okay.
So a 5 pound package being delivered from a large retail chain to a home within 5 miles. That's an addressable market. But where those applications could be implemented really comes down to an implementation strategy. And I think what we have to do in this country specifically is address three key issues. Safety first. Obviously, there has to be safety.
You don't want drones going in and take people's
Correct.
Heads off. Okay, go on.
If it's not a safe application, then obviously there's going to be some federal issues with that, and people will take
some social issues as well.
Right,
okay,
social
so safety first.
Safety first. The second thing has to be consumer confidence, right? Because not uncommon now. Think about the way things used to be back in the day when you could open up a catalog and you could order something. That that risk was all on the delivery mechanism because it was all cash on delivery, right? So you order something out of a catalog on the phone, and it showed up. And you paid for it on the spot. And if you didn't have the cash to pay for it, it was brought back home. That's not the case now. So all of the risk is on the consumer now to pay for something online and have it delivered to your house. So that has to be an addressable issue because
right.
if we can't give the consumer confidence that the package in question that costs $50, $100, $1,000 is going to arrive without any kind of damage or on time.
Well, but, you know, I've got to be honest. I'm actually surprised that we don't see any drones delivering anything. I mean, honestly,
right.
And not only do we not see any drones, but there's been such controversy over testing. There's, you know, even having, you know, potential test runs. So, you know, how realistic is it that this will play any kind of meaningful part in the delivery of packages
sure.
anytime in the near future?
Sure. The great news is that there are federal agencies that are working on what's called the Unmanned Aerial System Transportation Management System, UTM. And that's going through testing phases right now. And the idea behind UTM is to provide oversight from air traffic control perspective on where commercial applications are being utilized of drones. I think the fastest way forward for delivery mechanisms is actually in a rural area where it's less congested. Ironically, this mirrors kind of what we're seeing on a global perspective from drone delivery mechanisms in third world countries, which are finding the fastest proliferation of drone deliveries because of the need to get medicine, food, water, things to areas.
Which countries are the most advanced in this?
So Tanzania, it would be an example of utilization of drone strategies to get needed medicine to remote areas in a faster fashion. And it's because there's no federal restrictions.
So who's running those operations?
Well, those are all being done in partnership with various different governments and foreign entities that are working on drone implementation strategies.
Okay. And you also talk about $127 billion of business that could be involving drones in some level by 2020. And I have to wonder, that can't all be shipping and packages.
Gosh, no.
What are sort of the majority?
Infrastructure monitoring.
Okay.
So telecommunications and power distribution networks that need constant operations and maintenance have a heavy overhead with doing traditional rotary wing inspections. And there's a significant amount of danger associated with climbing up a cell tower to do an inspection. And if you think about the thousands of assets that exist within just one small entity of a country, all of them need to be inspected on a regular basis for vegetation encroachment, birds nesting. These are all things that cause your broadband to go down on your system. That, you know,
okay.
Right? And so as a consumer, you want that to be taken care of. So the companies have to do operations and maintenance, gain a tremendous boost in return on investment for using drone strategies.
Chris, real quick, what companies stand to benefit the most as drones are adopted in a more accelerating manner?
I think the power distribution, oil and gas, have the biggest benefit because you can use drones in a long-haul environment where you're taking a look at distribution networks for areas like that have rolling blackouts, that you could reduce blackouts. You're going to get the biggest bang for the buck as far as customer satisfaction at that point.
Chris Hewlett, thank you so much for joining us here at the National Postal Forum in Maryland.
Thanks.
Chris Hewlett is manager of U.S. drone-powered solutions at PricewaterhouseCoopers in Washington, D.C. Also, he was a 21-year veteran of the Navy, flying around, getting a lot of experience, so this does not mystify him, unlike some of the rest of us. We are here in Baltimore at the National Postal Forum, which is a partner of the United States Postal Service. And we're talking about how to transform the concept of mail, physical, tangible, on-the-ground mail, in an era that's increasingly focused on your smartphone and on your tablet. And who better to do that for us, to understand kind of this connection and this evolution, is Preetha Mehra. She's Vice President of Mail Entry and Payment Technology at USPS, and she joins us here now in Baltimore at the conference. Thank you so much for joining us, Preetha. So what is sort of the forefront right now, the way that the United States Postal Service is trying to make it more sort of amenable to the digital era? What are the frontiers, if you will?
Well, imagine if you could carry your collection box with you everywhere you go, your mailbox. That's what we're doing. We're putting your mailbox into your phone, into your email, so that you can actually sign up. And for those that haven't, I'm going to encourage you to sign up to our informed delivery platform. It's fantastic.
So hold on a second.
You see picture images of every mail piece that's coming to your mailbox. Boy, are we bringing that mail piece alive.
Okay, hold on 1 second. So this means that you can see the actual items of mail that would be in your mailbox. Can you digitally open them? I mean, is it something where you basically are getting all of your mail digitally, or you just can sort of take inventory of what you have and take stock?
Well, there's a lot going on with that. So you can see the picture of the mail piece, and then advertisers can attach a ride-along coupon or an image. They can attach a URL so that, you know, when you see this image, you can click through and you could go into an entirely new experience. So it's essentially bringing mail alive. It's got a huge personality. With every mail piece, you can click and you can be rendered into a whole new experience.
So I'm trying to think, because Paul Sweeney of Bloomberg Intelligence was on earlier, and he was talking about how an increasing number of direct mailers are trying to use online information to then better target people with physical pieces of mail. And yet this seems to be a way that people could potentially bypass the physical sort of direct mailings and sort of attach coupons and other things. I'm just confused as sort of how to be the most effective through this means.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
So, yeah, you got it all wrong. So let me tell you.
Great. Set me straight.
No, what it is what we're doing is we're creating multiple impressions. So think about it. We've got a boatload of social media clutter today, right? And so mail stands out. So what this does is you get this mail piece, you keep the mail piece with you. Perhaps you've got an augmented reality going on that mail piece. You can then, you know, shine your phone on it and you can be rendered another experience. With informed delivery, you're getting an image of your mail piece, so you know, hey, there's something really important in my mailbox, I gotta go get it. You can also then click into that image and think about the world of advertisers, and they can link that physical catalog with multiple experiences. So you're gonna have multiple expressions, impressions, expressions, and multiple experiences.
So how soon is this being rolled out, or is it already happening?
Oh, it's all rolled out, and if you haven't signed up, you're missing the boat there. So I'm going to tell
I'm
you,
missing
you,
the boat.
Yes,
not
you
it.
Are. You're
all right then.
You can sign up now. Advertisers can start using it, and we've got some huge success stories. Let me tell you about some open rates. Okay, our email open rates are over 70%. We're getting response rates in the high 7, 8, 9%.
Where's the biggest adoption right now?
It's retailers. It's
No, I mean like locations in the U.S. I mean, is it very specific geographically where people are sort of more...
Well, when we rolled it out, we started in the top metro area. So that, of course. And so, you know, and we are getting... consumers are signing up at an alarming rate. We have over 2 million registered subscribers. So those eyeballs are increasing every day.
You know, we talk a lot about how in the Amazon era, people are shipping a lot more in order just to sort of order things online, bring it to their doorstep. But what about personal letters? Because I feel like emails kind of have overwhelmed that. Have you found that there is something special? You're saying that there is something different or, you know, distinctive about getting a physical piece of mail. You know, have you seen sort of the drop in personal letters kind of stabilize and people going back to that at all, or...
I think we are seeing that millennials, believe it or not, are loving mail. So people are going back because they realize the power of that mail piece. Because now that you've got all this different communications, mail is just a different experience. You go home, you access it when you want it. You're not reading it amongst 70,000 other emails or Facebook or this or that that you have to go through. You're actually interacting with it at your own pace. So you have a different relationship. You have a calmer relationship. You have a more sustaining relationship with that mail piece than you do with all the social media. And I think people are realizing the power of that relationship.
Thank you so much for joining us. Sounds like an exciting time, and for being here in Baltimore. Preetha Mehra, she is the Vice President of Mail Entry and Payment Technology for the United States Postal Service, talking about different payment systems. Well, she didn't get quite into that, but she was talking about the digitization of what your mailbox looks like and how you can check what's there, and some possible opportunities for marketers as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz 1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.